What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I am Jamie Dodd. My co-host is Canucks insider Thomas Drance, who also covers the team for The Athletic. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drancer, what's going on, man? What is going on is that I cannot hear you, buddy. So we'll get that figured out. I can see the lips moving on the monitor here, but I cannot hear you. So we'll get that figured out, and we will get Drancer on to the show momentarily. Of course, Drancer is still working remotely for one more week here, I believe. But I got to admit, I'm very excited for the show today. A lot to get into. Last week was really the dry period as far as NHL Canucks specifically, but also just in general, of course, with the big layoff before the Stanley Cup final. You know, we wondered if we might see a big trade or something happen around the league. It didn't go down like that. But now we're really into the accelerated portion of the NHL calendar. We're exactly 3 weeks away from the opening of free agency on July 1st. And of course, in that time, we're going to squeeze in the remainder of the Stanley Cup final, you know, potentially six more games. We'll see, maybe three more games only. And then, of course, the draft as well, leading in to NHL free agency awards night too. So a lot is going to happen in the next 3 weeks, setting up, you know, free agent frenzy on July 1st. And one of the things we'll get into for the course of the day, you know, we found out what the NHL salary cap is going to be going to next year. Do we have you there?
Hey, Jamie.
Yeah, we got you.
You got me?
We got you.
Let's go smooth. We're always slick here.
Monday morning, baby. We're working the kinks out on a Monday morning.
So sorry, you've been, I was enjoying you rolling out the hockey news Armageddon that we're in here for the next 3 weeks.
Well, it really felt like, as I was saying, like last week was just a total desert of news, right? It was so slow and, you know, just nothing happening. And now, you know, starting with Gary Bettman's kind of State of the Union address and with Marty Walsh, we know what the salary cap is going to be, right? And we're starting to hear, we've got a ton of different reports from Elliot Friedman and Rick Dhaliwal we can talk about. Your salary cap projection is up at The Athletic. And, you know, all of a sudden now, we're 3 weeks away from July 1st. We're 3 weeks away from free agent frenzy. And, of course, we'll finish the Stanley Cup final. We'll have the draft before that. So after the kind of the deep breath, the pause, the inhale of last week, we're going to get a lot happening in short order here over the next few weeks.
Yeah, and look, for me, the $88 million upper limit of the salary cap agreed to and announced formally, like codified, done, lock it in, by the NHL and the NHLPA on Saturday prior to game one is the biggest story. Like the biggest bit of uncertainty. Now, obviously I'd say that, right? But I truly believe it from a lens wider than my own personal one, right? Like I think if we zoom out, I think here's the facts, right? From 2018 through to 2023, a 5-year period, the cap went up from 79.5 to 83.5 million. That's a $4 million lift across 5 years, like the entire duration of our show, you know, recent memory for most people. And this summer, it will go up by more than that, $4.5 million. Like, I don't think it's possible in some ways to overstate what a rupture that is from the sort of state of play for the hockey business dating back a half decade, right? Regular cap growth, if we're lucky enough for that to come down the pike, and I'll talk about this a little bit more, but the like the uncertainty side of it, the don't just take lifts, consistent lifts to the bank necessarily, right? But this lift, the flexibility that it affords teams this summer, you know, the additional 120 plus million that this is going to put into the NHL system as a whole, in terms of cap flexibility, like the impact's going to be mammoth. Like the last 5 years, we've seen almost a warping of the way that we discuss the sport, right? It's like, hey, I like that player. He's good. What's his contract? It's not valuable enough, right? Like the line for NHL teams between signing a good player to a fair market deal and an egregious mistake that will meaningfully hold back your team. Like, the line has disappeared. It's not even just a fine line. There's almost no line between it. 85%, 90% of the league has spent much of the last few years available for free to any team that would be able to take on the full freight of their salary and, you know, and send back a mid-round pick. Unfortunately, very few teams had the freight to take on that salary, especially the teams that wanted actual players now. Salaries have stagnated. I mean, across the board, like honestly, the on-ice product, teams have had to be top-heavy, yeah. Right? We've seen teams go without backup goaltenders, skate short a man, abuse LTI. I mean, we've seen all of this stuff that has impacted how teams are built, how they play on the ice, tactics for front offices, fewer trades. Like, so many things have been shaped by this flat cap era, and now we're on the other side of it. And for the Canucks, I think that's, you know, obviously phenomenally exciting on a variety of fronts, but namely that this rising salary cap tide is met by the fact that for the first time in a long time, the club actually went into last offseason and made conservative bets and managed the term on depth players. And like, there are some regrettable commitments that weren't inherited by this management team, right? But for the most part, they've been pretty diligent at untangling what was a gruesome salary cap situation 2.5 years ago. And like, suddenly they're here and it's more than $25 million in flex as it stands today. Granted, with a ton of roster spots to fill, you know, I think as we discuss Dolly Wall's Jalen Chatfield report and, you know, the latest will they, won't they from Elliot Friedman on Elias Lindholm, you know, as we dive into that, I think the major takeaway, the big picture thing I'd say to people is like, a world with $4.5 million year over year cap growth is a new one, like a new one for NHL teams. Like, we're not going to be in a mode anymore, or at least for a bit, where, you know, every deal signed needs to be rigorously sort of applied or discussed within the context of like the efficiency test, right? The opportunity cost. The teams that do best are still going to be the teams that are most disciplined in terms of the commitments they make and how they manage the cap. But we're going to see some eye-popping numbers on July 1, like some numbers that give us real sticker shock that within 18 months are going to probably look completely routine. And in fact, maybe even valuable. I do think we're going to be in this mode where we're still talking about the choices teams make as if it's 2021, and it ain't. And so I almost think it's like almost like a weight is lifted where we can kind of talk a little bit more about like hockey fit,
yep.
Hockey topics, and less about sort of the crushing austerity of the flat cap and what those implications are for what teams need to be prepared to do without and how creative they have to be in replacing players, you know, basically for free when they depart.
And the value and efficiency discussion, I mean, that's inherent in a hard cap system, right? So it's not going to go away completely. You can still make mistakes. You can still overpay players, even if the salary cap does keep going up and taking these jumps in the years going forward. But it's just, it shouldn't be as dominant a part of the conversation as it has been for the last 4 or 5 years, right? And I mean, that has so many different ramifications for how teams go about their business. I mean, I think about the Canucks potentially trying to shop Ilya Mikheyev, but would you want to pay a sweetener to move a contract now when we might be in kind of the last days of that really happening, right? Like, if the salary gap is going up significantly, how much is that even going to be a thing in any way like it has been over again, like since 2018, since 2019, where we've seen that so frequently? And I think for the Canucks in particular, you know, you mentioned the discipline from last summer in particular that has landed them in this position. And with the, so it's up to $88 million now. And as you say, it's never certain that it's going to keep going up, but there's at least a roadmap where you can imagine that this is the first of a similar jump next year, right? And we could be, you know, $92 million, $92.5 million, something like that going into next season. And just kind of thinking about that and that process for the Canucks, one of the ways I'm looking at this offseason now is, you know, can you set yourself up this summer, not just for next season, not just to try to take a step forward for next season, but also to be in a good position to manage the two most painful OEL buyout seasons coming up. I think that's got to be a huge part of this, the discussion this summer, right? Is, yeah, you've got the salary cap relief, and if you get another jump next year, if those two combine those two things, right, the salary cap going up with your own smart decisions, you should be able to put yourself in a place to at least somewhat mitigate the pain from the OEL buyout coming up down the road. Right now, job one has to be fill the needs on your team, try to take that step forward, get better however you can. But it doesn't all of a sudden, you know, discipline doesn't completely fly out the window just because the salary cap has gone up for any team, but especially not the Canucks, because they do have that OEL buyout jump coming up down the road. All right, Drance is doing the thing where his he's moving but not making noise again. So we might have dropped him again. But we will try to get Drance reconnected momentarily here. And somebody texted in. I don't think so, Drance. I think the way we link contracts and performance is here to stay, unfortunately. And look, there's always going to be an element of that. As I said, in a hard cap reality, right, there's always got to be a bottom line related to what you're making. And look, even without a salary cap, you look at Major League Baseball, right? Fans complain.
Jamie,
about,
you got me.
Yeah, I got you now.
No, I had a complex reaction to what you were talking about, which is what I wanted to
so
get into.
Complex it broke the internet connection.
Apparently. although I think that was the champagne glass on my tuchus. Break the internet?
What a pull. Yeah, sorry, it took me a second, but I got there.
I think I threw you off by the use of the word tuchus.
Yep. Not how I would generally yep. describe Kim Kardashian's, but whatever.
So I've actually been having this thought because I feel like there's two countervailing evolutions happening in the sport that I think are going to shape things really significantly if they continue to trend this way. Now, these evolutions, or at least one of them, both of them, I think, are more pendulums, right? It's more like a shift of an ever evolving pendulum as opposed to something like entirely new. And I think we need to discuss them with an understanding that, like an elastic band, you know, this could snap back quickly, yep. right? So you've got the cap growth side of it, right? And just over the last decade, we've had three moments where the cap rather unexpectedly stopped growing for reasons pertaining to literally pestilence, a massive currency fluctuation,
yep.
and a stock market crash. Like, just in the cap era, so since 2008, we've had three major moments where the cap went flat due to, you know, pandemic, stock market crash in 08, and then, of course, the Canadian currency devaluing in whatever that was, 2013, 14. And in two of those cases, it was like completely unexpected, right? Like, the NHL tabulates revenue and sort of comes to these agreements. Like, to have the cap be 88 million now, an agreement done this far in advance, is unusual. Like, yep. there's years on the draft floor where teams still don't know exactly how much they have to spend, even as they're committing some of that money. I mean, it's been the Wild West some years, based on where the relationship is with the PA and the league, where the health of business is, on and on. And this year we have certainty early and we have a lift early, but you'd be naive in the extreme to move forward with the idea that, like, we're now in a period of unrestrained cap growth, right? It's like real business sure. realities, television rights deal expiring, the health of RSNs, true world events outside anyone's control can quickly bring that to a halt. But in the interim, I do think it's reasonable to expect a several year runway in which the cap accelerates, right? And that's going to have massive implications. The other evolution I think that we're on, and again, this is pendulum stuff. This is something that could swing back abruptly, but probably not nearly as abruptly as cap growth just coming to an unexpected halt, is the shift in scoring and scoring rates in the NHL. It's like we've moved out of what I'm now going to call the fixed percentages era. Right?
Right.
So the fixed percentages era where, you know, 95% of the league was going to fall between 7.5 and 8.5% save percentage or on ice shooting percentage. And 919 was an average save percentage for a goaltender. Now it's 905, right? Like, the way that shooters have become, have begun to win their matchups against NHL goaltenders at a rate, you know, far more common to what we saw in like the 1980s or the early 90s, like pre-Butterfly era. It's like the reversal of a generation-long trend, which has favored goaltenders, which has favored defense. Now, what does that mean, right? Because I think this is a really interesting one, and I think we're seeing it play out. In a world where players, especially elite players, are able to meaningfully drive and sustain elevated shooting percentage, right? That means that the NHL becomes somewhat less of, not entirely less, but somewhat less of the sort of weak link sport that it has been for our entire adult lives, Jamie.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you go look at who we used to win the cup in the 1970s and the 1980s, and in a world where shooters regularly scored on, you know, 11, 12% of their shots. You'll see a lot of Gretzky. You'll see a lot of LaFleur. You'll see a lot of Bossy.
Yep.
You'll see a lot of Lemieux, right? And then you see the butterfly, and then you see, oh boy, you know, it's really the team with the best third line that plays lockdown defense, that also stays healthy, that gets lucky. It's like a game where all you can do is stack the deck, have a weighted coin flip where you have a 53% chance of winning, you know, 100, like the 60% of 100 coin flips, right? And it's like, you might, but you might not, right? And in a world where we're going to see true talent, top-level true talent, have a greater impact on outcomes, a world where, say, a heavily flawed Edmonton Oilers team can storm through the Western Conference, or where, you know, the Florida Panthers, with an elite player on their second line, in addition to the best defensive center in hockey and a great first pair, can, like, disguise the fact that, you know, they've got a third pair with Kulikov and Ekman-Larsson, and, you know, that their fourth line got absolutely bludgeoned by the New York Rangers. Like, a few years ago, Barkley Gaudreau scoring 6 goals in a conference final, it's like, that's the difference.
Yep.
You know, now it's like, well, and it didn't matter because Matthew Tkachuk took over things, right? The Canucks give the Oilers fits in that second round. Well, it doesn't matter because when McDavid and Dreisaitl or Bouchard and Ekholm, when the Oilers' top end is on the ice, the Canucks don't generate anything themselves and the Oilers overwhelm them. These two evolutions coming at the same time, I think, is a really fascinating set of challenges, or poses a really fascinating set of challenges and questions for the Canucks, especially because this team that we saw succeed so greatly this past season was built, as we've said a million times, on just like a run of floor bets. You know what I mean? And even stylistically, the way they win on defense, on being deeper than you up front, especially early in the year, you know, on having balance, right? On goaltending advantage, especially when Demko's healthy. I'm not even saying that, like, you can't skin a cat in the way that the Canucks are trying to necessarily. But the suggestion that I'd have for you is that in a world where the game is evolving in this direction, should it continue, do you really want to be the deep team playing lockdown defense? Or are you building a team to win in 2012 for 2024, when the game maybe is on the verge of changing, especially as all of the best teams in the league for the first time in 5 years are about to get this sort of moment of cap growth, right? Is this a moment to, in fact, chase ceiling, or do you double down on an approach that might be passe, that might be, you know, the sky dome of NHL team building strategies, where it opens in the next year, everyone's like, wow, it's so futuristic. This is what the future of live sports and entertainment looks like. And then the next day, Jacobs Field opens, and everyone's like, we want intimate and outdoors. And what you've built is dated. So I'm not even concluding that that's the case, but it's something that I was thinking about a lot watching Florida and Edmonton play, and watching that McDavid and Barkov matchup. And frankly, watching the Panthers have no answer for McDavid, right? Like, the Barkov, I know he scores the goal against McDavid and they did some thoughtful stuff to shut him down, but, like, I didn't think the Oilers' top end would run roughshod like that over the Oilers over the Panthers territorially. And yet I'm watching it happen and I'm just like, man, is this now a league where, far more like the NBA, you know, we're looking at series and saying, well, who has the best player? Who has the best top end? You know, are we going to keep going into these series and anyone talking about hockey like it's 2016 and being like, well, Edmonton can't handle Dallas's depth is going to look pretty silly 5 games in, right? Is this a new era and what does that mean? And both of these things, the cap going up at the same time that shooting percentage is going up, that percentages are less fixed and elite skill matters more in shaping outcomes. To me, those are connected in a way that actually could be really, really good for growing the game, right? Like, yep. That could actually improve the product. But I do think poses some tough questions for NHL management teams and thinking about what to prioritize, how to spend, and how to improve in this new environment.
Well, I also think it has huge implications for what to do with the newfound cap flexibility, right? Like, don't, okay, hey, yep. we can afford to spend on our third line center now is probably not going to be the correct takeaway, right? It's, hey, we got to do whatever we can to go find those difference makers. And I'm not talking about the Canucks specifically. I'm talking just generally, right? Although it certainly applies to the Canucks as well. The goal is going to be go and find those difference makers at the top of your lineup. I also think it's kind of ironic that, you know, we're having this conversation about it moving more towards the NBA, where it's a top player versus top player thing now, where we're seeing the NBA finals far and away. The guy who's performing best is Luka Doncic, and yet it doesn't matter because the NBA has kind of shifted in the other direction and become more of a just your depth and your starting lineup is so important now. Anyways, I think the other thing that's really fascinating about the two things happening, right, the huge increase in scoring and the salary cap bump is, I think we all intellectually know that scoring has gone way up, but we haven't fully adjusted how we evaluate players based on their counting stats as a result, right? So we all know scoring is up, but we also look at like, wow, this guy had 90 points as in some ways as if it was 90 points from 10 years ago. You know what I mean? Like, right. We haven't quite adjusted.
Where you won the Art Ross with 87.
Exactly. And like, you look at like Sam Reinhart this year, and Sam Reinhart, phenomenal player. Don't get me wrong. I mean, 57 goals,
yeah, awesome.
Right? Like I love the player. You know, he was 12th in league scoring with 94 points, right? Like, again, 10 years ago, he's winning the Art Ross with 94 points, right? Now he was on the
outside. With margin.
Yeah. Now he was on the outside of the top 10. And I think that combination, like, some of these guys are going to make incredible, incredible money because in the transition period where the cap has gone up, scoring has gone up and their scoring has gone up, but we haven't completely adjusted like, okay, what does being an 85 point player mean now differently than it would have a decade ago, right? And the guys who are in that spot who have benefited from the increase in scoring and are also hitting the open market just as the cap starts to go up, like, that is the sweet spot for a player making an absolutely incredible deal over the next couple of years here.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's a good time to be a free agent. We're going to see some contracts, I would expect, over the next 3 weeks that have almost a limited relationship to what's come before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are going to lose their minds. And I think we're going to look back in 18 months at least some of those and say, well, that ended up just being market value. You know, there's a million examples from other sports and there's a million examples previously in the NHL, like Blake Wheeler signing for 4.5 mm-hmm. in 2015. I remember everyone going nuts, like 4.5 million. That's a lot for a first line player. Right. And it's like, what? So, yeah, things are about to change in a massive way. Things are changing both on the ice and in the books. And I actually think there's a really fascinating sort of nexus between those two that I want to talk about in terms of, you know, some of the Chatfield news, some
yep.
of the Lindholm reporting that's come out today, in addition to sort of the cap flexibility article that I wrote at The Athletic. Like, I actually think there's a through line here that I want to get into in segment two.
Yeah, we'll dive into some of the specific reports that I mentioned that are out there about the Canucks and some of their offseason targets or offseason plans in the next segment. And by the way, we'll touch on this, I'm sure, as well. Somebody texted it in. Speaking of the cap, RIP, cap friendly. Yeah, cap friendly. Going away in a bit less than a month per Elliot Friedman. So we can touch on that. We'll get into some of the Canucks reports and Dranser's latest at The Athletic. That's coming up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650, brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintech Studio, 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. We were talking big picture salary cap increase in the first segment. It'll be $88 million next season. The NHL made that official over the weekend. And now we can zoom in a little bit to some of the reports that are out there about the Canucks and their own free agents. And also in this case, and this might be the first time, I'm trying to think, in this cycle, Dranter, that we've really heard the Canucks' interest in a external unrestricted free agent reported. But Rick Dhaliwal from Donnie and Dolly, of course, on Czech TV and regular here on the crossover with us, reporting today that the Canucks will be interested in defenseman, right shot defenseman Jalen Chatfield, former Canuck, of course, this summer, if he gets to market. He also notes that the player will have a ton of interest generally, and Carolina is trying to re-sign him. It's a player that Rod Brind'Amour really likes. But that is the report from Rick Dhaliwal, that Jalen Chatfield, 28-year-old right-shot defenseman who had 22 points with the Hurricanes this past season, potential target for the Vancouver Canucks if he's there on July 1st.
Yeah, and look, there's some people still with the Canucks. Ryan Johnson, who was a player development hand when Chatfield was last with the Canucks, worked closely with Chatfield, obviously was the general manager of Abbotsford too, who, you know, are definitely fond of the player and know the work ethic closely. And we know how familiarity often stimulates interest between professional sports organizations and the athletes they pursue in free agency. You know, the thing is with 22 points, right-handed shot, relatively young, physical style, you know, Chatfield's one of those guys who qualifies for me as, like, fans think it's a buy low.
But it probably won't be.
Maybe it shakes out that way, but it won't necessarily. Like, I won't be stunned if that guy's fielding $2.5-3 million offers when the market opens on July 1. The prospect of adding Jalen Chatfield, we like. The prospect of adding Jalen Chatfield for $12 million total dollars, do we like that as much?
Not as
much.
Or
does that give us some pause?
Not as much.
So it's an interesting one. Chatfield is, like, I think a really good systems executor, which we've seen what the Canucks can do with that. And yet, you know, I remain convinced that I think this team needs to be really focused too on making sure to add, like, a higher probability, increase the chances of them generating a quality look in minutes when Hughes and JT Miller aren't on the ice together. You know, Pettersson too from earlier in the year, but obviously less so in the second half. So, you know, again, this team was so top heavy in terms of how they threaten teams, not necessarily how they scored, because this team was super opportunistic. But, you know, as we've seen, the problem with being opportunistic is when it dries up, it looks like you're out of answers if you're not generating quality looks. And I think that's, like, everything that the Canucks need to be focused on in regards to, you know, what comes next for the team, which I think dovetails too, Jamie, with, I'm using dovetails a lot. I don't know. I'm like a John Woo movie today.
You're going to start doing it in slow motion.
Yeah, exactly. That would be sick. Slow motion takes, just like white birds flying out from beneath me, or behind me anyway. Maybe beneath. I don't know. We'll see what the cinematographer says. With regards to the Elias Lindholm update on 32 Thoughts. So,
well, hold on. Just on Chatfield, because your point about they need to, like, the focus on generating scoring chances, I think, is absolutely correct. You also need to fill out the bottom of your roster, right? And that's where it really depends on, is he a true buy low or not, right? Because if he is a relatively buy low, then it's like, okay, that's a home run. As soon as you start to be paying a bit of a premium, then it becomes a question of, okay, well, are those cap dollars that should be better allocated somewhere else, right? Like, do you need to find a true buy low for the spot on the roster that he's likely going to fill? Because, you know, if Philip Ronick and Tyler Myers are both back, I mean, he's your third pair right shot defenseman in all likelihood, or maybe a little interchangeability there with Tyler Myers. So how much can you really afford to spend on that spot, I think, is the question. And there's a certain number where you love Jalen Chatfield, but to your point, with the needs farther up the lineup, they have to be so disciplined about filling out those bottom of the roster spots.
Yeah, and I especially like the stylistic fit with how Rick Tocchet wants his defenders to play. I think there's something that could really be there. So I want to be clear that I'm not in any way throwing sand on the notion so much as, you know, I do think. So anyway, this is why I want to go to Lindholm, because I think this also helps us work forward to sort of the Canucks overall cap situation and then the overall challenge of the offseason as I see it in the event that our listeners care. The Lindholm report. So last week, 32 Thoughts reported Canucks 7x$7 million offer. Something they'd be willing to do. I don't know, like,
not a firm offer.
Let's not get
a
lost in
semantics
of formal offers.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But they'd be willing to do that. They want to keep the player. Seems like that's not going to be enough, which honestly, it's such a weird one, right? Because it's like, on the one hand, of course it's not going to be enough. He's a right-handed top of the lineup centerman in a market where that doesn't exist. And obviously that guy's going to get paid. On the other hand, he had 6 5-on-5 goals this past season. So it's a really tough market to gauge, but you know, 7x7, I mean, the evolving hockey model, for example, projects him to make $1 million more than that per year, right? So it's like, yeah, a lot of the signs are pointing toward that being light from Lindholm's perspective, and that's the latest update from Friedman and Merrick. Seems that the Canucks are you know, not losing hope, but are unlikely to be able to get the deal done at that level.
The
right?
way
the club will have to move
the way that Friedman
in order to get that done.
The way that Friedman phrased it was the Canucks internally are kind of saying, we're probably not going to be able to keep Lindholm. What's our next option? Right. So not closing the door, but starting to look to, okay, that's not going to happen. What do we do? What do we do next as an alternative?
And again, I loved the center depth. I thought it was some of the best center depth in the league when this club was able to go 940, 23 down the middle. But you know, I also think there's an element to which spending like that on a third line center, you know, unless one of Pettersson or Miller or both are on occasion jumping out to the wing, caps your ceiling a bit, right? Mm-hmm. Like it might help you consolidate the play style that made this team effective this year. And there's obviously value in that, but you're also paying for some of the stuff that's most affordable on the market in terms of defensive skill, face-off winning, penalty killing for centermen, and kind of committing a lot of cap dollars to a guy who did not meaningfully up this team's ability to generate scoring chances, which again is sort of the concern that I'm so obsessed with, because it's what has mattered more than anything else in this playoffs. And I think you need to be able to do it if you're going to contend for a Stanley Cup. And as everyone knows, that's always where we start. Like, what does this mean for Vancouver's probability of finally seeing a Stanley Cup banner above the rink at Rogers Arena? And Lindholm, you know, a good player, a good fit. I think if you signed him, there's still a path to winning. It's just, again, that narrower path reliant on defense and goaltending and you know, winning in a way that I worry might be a little bit passe. And this sort of brings us to Vancouver's overall cap situation. So I finally had the time to model it. I've been threatening to do so for, 10 days now?
Uh-huh.
But I finally had the time last night to do it, and I was inspired to do so by the $88 million number. And, like, you know, the way that if you go visit Cap Friendly, soon to be RIP, or Puckpedia, right, you'll see that the Canucks have, like, in the mid-20s in terms of cap space. But when you actually dive into it and, you know, make some of the assumptions that matter, right? So you've got the $2.3-ish million Oliver Ekman-Larsson buyout penalty. You know, you include all the players who played in at least 30 games for the Canucks last season as being on the 23-man roster. You exclude one-way contracts like Akito Hirose, who didn't meet that benchmark, and you include Pod Colson, who doesn't because he makes over $1 million and seems like a safe bet to be on the roster. And, you know, you get 14 bodies on the roster, okay? Once you then sort of free up the $2.5 million from Tucker Poolman going on LTI, and of course it doesn't quite work like that, you have to capture a set amount of it, blah blah blah, but once you really include that, then the functional amount of cap space that the Canucks can add is closer to 27.5, Jamie.
Uh-huh.
Like, what we're talking about is 27.5 million. There are, in terms of what's functionally available to teams this summer, there are really five teams with more buying power than Vancouver has over the next month. and they're like the worst teams in the league and Detroit. It's Utah, it's San Jose, it's Chicago. Like, it's the teams that are going to have to pay the bad team premium, like the bad team tax,
yep,
to entice free agents to join them in a way that Vancouver is not, especially after how last season went. And, you know, even if you get Hronek done and Seelov's done and assume it costs $7 or $8 million to do so, to do both, you know, then you're looking at 7 bodies to add to the lineup. Still a lot of work to do on defense, although at least you have your top pair locked up. Still need some upgrades for the wings, but you're still in a spot with above average buying power, right? Like, you're still in a spot where you can do like the biggest ticket item, like Lindholm, you know, Myers at not the hometown discount everyone hopes for, but more like a market rate, $3.5-4 million number, you know, and still have like $10 million available to flesh out your roster. I mean, the sheer options available to this team are through the roof. Like, this is not a normal, this is not your ordinary Canucks offseason where it's like, they're going to have to beg, borrow, steal to carve out cap space. What assets should they part with?
Yep.
Do they need to use a buyout to do their business? Like, they could even create $3 million more with a Ilya Mikheyev buyout. But when you have this much flexibility and the probable departure of some key forwards, like, why? There's no need to. You have so much space. You have so much flexibility. You have, you know, more buying power than anyone in the league, anyone relevant in the league, with the exception of Detroit. And even if you sign, you know, your top most important free agent, you're still going to have an above average amount of flex. So this is a really unique opportunity for the Canucks. And yet I find it so fascinating because it does feel like we're at another one of those forks in the road. And these are the forks in the road that always come up for this franchise, where it's, you know, ceiling versus floor, mm-hmm. patience versus instant gratification. And we all know which route this organization likes to pick. It's just that over the last 12 months anyway, the last 12 to 18 months anyway, at least the path they've picked has worked on the ice, right? So that's been a big change. But I don't think the fundamental shape of it, that this is a, you know, classically impatient organization, that this is an organization that seems to prioritize floor and playoff berths ahead of doing some bigger stuff to win a cup or to meaningfully contend. I still think that exists as like a dynamic underlying some of our, and it should underlie some of our assumptions about our team, about this team, and do best explain some of the ways that in which this club operates and the decisions they decide to make. So, you know, you're talking about filling out the roster, right? And I'm pretty much convinced here, Jamie, that filling out the roster obviously matters. And I don't think this team can play hard or like fast and loose with not continuing to sort of ruthlessly use their pro scouting to fill yep. out all the needs and eliminate the hope bets and raise the floor of this team and play Rick Tocchet-Hockey. I don't think you can take this season for granted and be like, we can go into next season with an unfinished product up front and sort of tweak it as we go along, because, you know, you need to improve enough to ward off some of the inevitable regression, which this club almost certainly will hit next year. And I mean, literally percentage regression, not performance regression. So there's a lot going on, but I still look at this lineup and don't think filling out the roster needs to be the priority here. It needs to be done too, but the priority for me needs to be that trickiest stage of all, that how do you get better players? How do you up the talent quotient? How do you make sure that JT Miller's, you know, not holding a knife at a gunfight the next time he bumps into 97 in the Stanley Cup playoffs? Like, how do you arm Canucks players with the surrounding high-end talent, not just the balanced talent, not just the glue guys, but the difference makers, right? Like that additional top six forward, that additional top pair defenseman, not two top fours,
yep.
top pair defenseman, you know, third line center. If Lindholm walks, that's going to be a big need to fill. Even if, you know, it's not a need that we think is a red shining light, like alert indicator that they should go spend freely on. And one of the best ways, Jamie, I'm increasingly thinking about that I think the Canucks might want to consider approaching this, right? Is to actually save some cap space, right? Like, we talk about this a fair bit when we talk about like Eichel and Zegras, and we have those debates about the, but like, if you're trying to land elite talent, you sometimes see it shake loose, like Matthew Tkachuk did or Pierre-Luc Dubois did, or like you see sometimes see it shake loose. But you know, we've commented on this, like if Reinhardt's staying in Florida, if Gensel doesn't want to come to Western Canada,
yeah, I mean, that's
who are you like, spending your cap space on?
This is one of the catches with cap space, right? Is free right. agency, like, yeah, again, if it's not Reinhardt or Gensel, there's no other guy who fits the bill on the market. And those, neither of those guys might be available to you anyways, in a true sense, especially Reinhardt, right? So, like, it's great to have the cap space, but there's inherently a very limited supply of true star talent ever that's going to be available as an unrestricted free agent.
So, you know, to channel the late, great Bill Walton, Jamie, I'm going to ask you to expand your mind, man. And
I was hoping you were going to say, throw it down, big man.
No, that's for me to do while you're expanding your mind.
Okay.
The thing that I sort of wonder about is if this team is clear-eyed about what's next, about what they need, the idea to get better players, not just get players that fit. I wonder about the approach of actually preserving some of this cap space. Like, I wonder if you go into this offseason and sort of try and treat it as like what you had to do last offseason, but double it up, right? Double it up.
Mm-hmm.
You need six players instead of three, you know, when the market opens on unrestricted free agency, and you have 20 million instead of 10, you know, but that's going to include re-signing Hronek. And, you know, we've seen what this club can do at the margins. We've seen how smart they are about pivoting. You know, in some ways it feels like a lot of the best moves they've made are moves that they've, you know, failed to make, right? Like the moves that they failed to make and then adjusted accordingly to, you know, everything from can't get Horvat done. Okay. Let's sign Miller, right? Not ultimately being able to trade Besser and Garland and,
yep,
and maybe Miller again, you know, I mean, it feels like pivoting is a real strength of this group, and certainly finding value in non-traditional spots is. So maybe lean into that and save your cap space, because a lot of the time when we see guys move, we see guys move like, and I mean, I'm not talking, maybe guys is the wrong word. I'm talking about when dudes move, like when the best guys move, oftentimes it's like late in the summer, there's a Danny Heatley trade request. And in order to fit Danny Heatley onto the roster, the San Jose Sharks need to create cap space. Wham. How about a free Christian Ehrhoff,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you see Jack Eichel in season move, Tomáš Hertl in season move. This is almost a derivative of how Vegas has hunted for elite players over the years, which is when the time comes, their use of LTI has given them the cap flexibility to make moves in season when everyone else is hamstrung because they've spent to the cap. And then in the offseason, when everyone has flexibility and is looking for players, that's when they dump Pacioretty. That's when they dump Nate Schmidt. That's when they create their flexibility to repeat the cycle. I almost wonder if that's a cycle the Canucks should consider getting on a little bit, especially in the short term here, especially because there's, I think, a real edge to this club's ability to creatively change gears in mid-course and swing mid-season deals, right? I mean, we've seen this club go out and identify and land, you know, good talented players in midstream, and then plug them into the lineup, and yeah, maybe there's some growing pains, but eventually Zadorov settled in and was a phenomenal. Eventually Lindholm settled in and was a difference maker in the playoffs. I mean, again, it feels to me like all of this management group's best strengths almost come to bear best in a situation where, hey, like maybe go into the season with only $79 million in cap space committed. Because then when those weird opportunities come about, when
yep,
a player shakes loose unexpectedly or is unhappy or it requests a trade or, you know, something falls from the sky as it does, that the Ehlers situation breaks down, the Marner situation comes to a head, the Anaheim Ducks can't get what they want for Trevor Zegras, and suddenly in October he's been a healthy scratch three times and by Greg Cronin, and now he's available for 60 cents on the dollar. Feels to me like those are the markets you want to be in, as opposed to, well, is Tyler Toffoli like Jake Gensel? You know, well, can we replace Lindholm with, I don't know, whatever centerman you want who's available? There aren't many.
Yeah.
it feels to me like that's where the Canucks want to be and should be. Like, I really am increasingly coming to the take anyway, that what might be best for the Canucks is to not avoid the stuff that matters in filling out their lineup, but keep their eyes trained higher on the horizon, looking for the big piece that can actually put this team over the top. Because I don't know that it's going to be there on July 1st, and I don't know that it's going to be there for a price that they can afford to pay necessarily during the offseason. It feels like almost later on they can make their biggest dent.
Well, and I think the point about retaining flexibility for later in the summer and going into the season is a good one. I also say, at a level even maybe less aggressive than that, do you retain your flexibility for next summer as much as you can, right? Like, because I think the point you're making, and I agree with, is just if you miss out on like the two A-plus free agents at forward, it doesn't mean you have to go long on some of the B-plus guys out there, right? Like, who knows what will transpire in the next 12 months? Will there be a player available at this time next year that you really like? I think it's a hard sell when you've made the second round, went to game 7, you want to take a step forward, to not have all your salary cap space committed going into the season, right? Or at least not very, yep, very close. That's a very hard sell. I'm not saying there's not wisdom behind it. I think there is. But I think at the very least, if you're not able to land one of the big fish, can you go, much like you did this past summer, short term with a lot of guys, right? So you're at least getting the contributors in, but it gives you the flexibility to either move them potentially, or at least going into next summer, you still have that cap space open, potentially even more cap space if the cap goes up again, right? Like, I hear what you're saying. I just think realistically, they're going to, if not completely max out the cap, come pretty close with contributors for this year. For me, the question is more just how much term do they attach to that? How much long-term risk do you have to take on to fill out a team that you feel good about this summer?
Yeah, I get it. I just think that's too conventional.
Yeah.
For all of the, like, for all of the gravity that this club is going to have to work against. And yet, I think you're right. Like, one of the other, you know, environmental changes that this club is coping with is elevated expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there's a real question. Like, it would be one thing if you thought, well, we can just roll it out, the same team minus $8 million off the cap, and we're going to be just as good. But, you know, it does feel like the gains that this club made this season, they always feel like a stepping stone in real time. And they're always more fragile than that. Especially given, you know, some of the indicators, whether it's save percentage or on and on, that surround this team, that, you know, they are going to be, you know, running uphill against the forces of regression next season.
By the way, we got to go to break, but I did have to read this. I don't know if you noticed me cracking up and trying to hold it together while you were talking during that segment, but this text came in. Segment one, the fabric of the universe has changed irrevocably, and we no longer need to be so torn over cap considerations. The axis of the earth is tilted to allow the perception of talent to prevail. Segment two, you can't sign Jalen Chatfield for $3 million. That was a very, very good text from an unsigned listener who then followed up with great show so far, guys. I'm really enjoying it. But that one really made me laugh. I got to be honest.
It's really good. We have to be self-aware to say, to doff our caps to that listener and say, you got us, you skewered us good. But I do want to note, I'm not saying don't do Chatfield at $3 million. I think he might be worth it. I just, you know, I more than anything, I'm sick of people doing the like, potential value signing for the Canucks, and it's Danton Heinen.
It's a guy who's going to be like, in serious demand around the league. Yeah.
Yeah, like you're 16 months late, man. Value signing Dylan DeMello. It's like, what?
Yeah.
31 points. He's going to get paid.
All right, we'll take a break here. We've got guests in both of the final two segments of the show. We'll check in with Zach Lang at Edmonton on the Stanley Cup Final next. And then our old pal Jonathan Wall will drop by. Lots to talk to with Jay Wall here coming up at 1:30. Cap-friendly, growth of the salary cap finally going up after the flat cap era. The Young Stars tournament coming back for another year. So lots to get into. We'll talk Stanley Cup Final next with Zach Lang here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.